It feels as if you've popped out of a small, cramped costume you've been wearing for many lifetimes. The boots were too tight, the buttons had fallen off, and although you were reluctant to let them go, they were so familiar they'd taken the shape of you. The otherness of freedom calls you, even when you've unzipped into something or someone you don't recognize. Even when what remains is only the toe of a ruby slipper on the heap of what you once called your life. Chapter 21, Snorkeling in the Night Sky. Night comes swiftly, like a great, dark, soft thing, and for most of my life I've greeted it reluctantly, as if behind the darkness lurked terror and shattered hearts. My mother says, "You were a fast napper from the day you were born. Other kids went down for 2 hours. You slept for 20 minutes and were up for the rest of the day." Even as an infant, I didn't want to surrender to that dark, soft thing. After an early menopause, I started waking up 3, 4, 5 times a night. At first, I tried natural remedies, melatonin, bioidentical hormones, cortisol, adaptogens, then unnatural ones, drugs. But since I have a paradoxical reaction to drugs, Ambien kept me awake, and during the second week I took Ativan, the first was heavenly, I developed suicidal proclivities and wanted to jump off a bridge. Then I downloaded sleep music, tried brain balancing techniques, listened to books on tape. Middlemarch, Team of Rivals, and A Passage to India are still my favorites. Also anything by Bill Bryson, except he makes me cackle, which wakes up my husband, which makes two of us wide awake at 3 a.m. Still, night after night, my eyes flew open like clockwork, and with them began the rattling of my mind and the descent into the catastrophic. The pain in my chest is congestive heart failure, I'm sure of it. The ugly, I've been married to the wrong person for 30 years, and the uglier. Was that noise a rapist? Where's my gun? Oh, right. I don't have one. In her book Marrow, Elizabeth Lesser calls this litany middle of the nightism, and she urges us not to believe any thoughts that occur between midnight and 6 in the morning. To that wise advice, I would add, and stop reading articles that tell you that not getting enough sleep can lead to Alzheimer's, ALS, and autoimmune disease, particularly if, like me, you might be a teeny bit prone to hypochondria. A few months ago, after lying in bed like a pencil in a drawer for hours each night, trying desperately to be peaceful and instead feeling insane and judgmental, after 40 years meditating, you still can't quiet your mind? I decided that if I couldn't sleep, I shouldn't sleep, and that there must be something I could do that didn't require putting on lights. Because as every insomniac knows, you're supposed to turn down all lights at dusk and keep your bedroom cool and dark to facilitate ongoing melatonin release. I remembered an article in The New Yorker in which the author says that before the advent of electricity and artificial light, people didn't sleep through the night. They'd sleep when it got dark, sleep one, and after a few hours, they'd wake up, congregate in small groups, and chat convivially. Then they'd trundle off to their stacks of hay and revive themselves with more sleep, which was called sleep two. Visiting friends in the middle of the night, having tea, biscuits, and a chat in flannel pajamas sounds quite civilized to me, like these newly emergent death cafes where strangers gather to eat cake, drink tea, and discuss death to help them make the most of their finite lives. In a sleepless cafe, strangers could huddle together and discuss being awake in the middle of the night. But since I live in the forest, half an hour away from any place where insomniacs might huddle, I decided to start my own nighttime ritual. Now, when my eyes fly open at 3, I follow my breath from my toes to the top of my head and back again a few times. Then I do the 4-7-8 sleep breath count, 4 on the in-breath, 7 on the top of the breath, 8 on the out-breath. Sometimes I listen to the elegiac writing of George Eliot. And if Mr. Casaubon doesn't aggravate me too much, I might fall asleep. But if I'm still awake after 15 minutes, I say in a purposefully cheerful whisper, "Time to go visiting!" The cheerful part is necessary to drown out and reprogram the doleful lament at not being able to sleep. I slip into my bright pink slippers with the floppy felt turquoise flowers, pad into the dark hall with my arms outstretched like a zombie, so that I don't bang into walls and trip over chairs, inch my way to the back door, exchange the slippers for my black knee-high Wellingtons, which I placed by the door the night before, put on my husband's puffy pumpkin-colored Antarctica coat, and grope for the door. Creak, door opens. Creak, door closes. Step down, look up. And just like that, I am in another world. The glittering bowl of the sky is so vast that it seems as if I am upside down, like the first time I went snorkeling and saw that the ocean had an underneath, undulating anemones, knobs of rutilant coral, neon purple and green rainbow fish, that must have been here all along, but because I never looked below the surface, I never knew. In the middle of the night, with the very first step, I feel as if I am snorkeling in the night sky, gliding around the stars, letting the consummate darkness penetrate my fevered mind. I can't believe that this underneath has been waiting for me all along. And if not exactly terrified of it, I've been highly suspicious of its secrets and vast mystery. An owl hoots. The sound ricochets against the trees between my thoughts. A mockingbird sings, and the notes feel as if they are rising from my sternum. The wind chimes, the ones that, according to the salesperson from whom we bought them, have been tuned to Amazing Grace, rustle against each other like tiny monastery bells. As my eyes adjust to the dark, I start walking, which feels like swimming. Outside is in, upside is down, the vastness in the sky and the space between my ribs and my chest and inside every cell is hollow and full, nothing and everything. I open my arms as wide as I can, as if I can scoop the stars like liquid mana into my throat, chest, legs. Once, twice, three times, the arms open, scoop, take in the stars and the darkness that makes them visible, while the trees, noble and immense, bear witness to this exchange of liquid light. Drenched in stillness now, my body moves back to the house, swims down the hallway, moves into bed, and dissolves like the space inside an anemone when it closes, like the deathless beauty of no me, no you, no world. Epilogue. Stop waiting to be ready. Stop trying to be the self you imagine you would be if you were smarter, prettier, thinner, kinder, more accomplished than you are. You've already done that. If it didn't work the first 1,000 times, it's not going to work now or ever. So you're still selfish. So you're still struggling with food and your weight. So you're still crazy in the middle of the night and sometimes in broad daylight. So is 99% of the population. I'm not saying to act on those feelings. I'm not advocating indulgence or collapse or despair. I'm saying it's time to stand in your own two shoes, It's time to be your own authority. You've given yourself away to programs, methods, big daddies for too long. Come back. As Glinda said to Dorothy, you've always had the power. If you're feeling selfish, don't push it away. Don't pretend you're nicer than you feel. Turn toward the selfishness, not away from it. Let yourself feel like the most selfish person in the universe without acting on it. Notice how it changes when you let it be there, feel it, accept it, and begin to pay attention to the noticer instead of what's noticed. If you're eating past fullness, stop. And if you don't stop, fine. But ask yourself what's going on. Notice what you feel, what arises inside you. Accept responsibility for your actions. You're not a child. You don't need to be regulated by an external authority, most particularly a diet. If you don't love your work, if you feel like a failure, if you're struggling to pay your bills, if you feel unlovable or worthless or crazy in the middle of the night, take a breath. Then take another. If you have cancer, if you're dying, pay attention. Listen. Look. Breathe. You've got a body, and that body responds to what you put into it. Listen to it. If sugar makes you feel depressed, stop eating it, even if it's on your eating plan. And rather than focus on how deprived you feel, ask yourself who it is that feels deprived. She's probably 5 or 8 or 12. Are you? Climb out of your mind and back into your body, even if it feels uncomfortable. Turn toward the feeling, not away from it. Treat yourself the way you would treat a small child who is lost, because that part of you is. Take yourself in. Ask the questions no one ever asked you. Keep going until you know the answer and you know who's asking, until you realize it's not far away, that the essence of you, like the sky, was always here. You just happen to get distracted by the local weather for a few decades. Do whatever you have to do. You already know what it is. Move your body or unwind the trauma that's in your nervous system. Leave or begin that relationship. Make doing what you have to do a priority for your life. Because if you don't, you leave yourself behind. And at your last breath, which will come sooner than you think, you will have missed showing up for this messy, magnificent life. You do not have to prostrate yourself at the feet of shame for one more minute or keep begging forgiveness for being yourself. We need you. We need you to stop waiting to be ready, to stop waiting to act until you become the self you imagine you would be if only you were different than you are. We need your radical truth-telling, your willingness to speak from your Montana-wide heart. But most of all, we need the unrepeatable essence of you. Come back. Now. Last words. Touchstones for breaking the trance. When I finished writing This Messy Magnificent Life, I realized I'd been using and teaching a set of 7 non-linear, non-sequential touchstones that I discovered and refined during 6 years of writing the book. Instead of adding them to your to-do list, sigh, use them to break the trance of everyday discontent, anxiety, and lack. If you turn any touchstone into a rule, it quickly becomes an instrument of shame and punishment. After that, well, you know what comes after that, rebellion, shame, and a series of what the hells. I knew I couldn't do this. I'm worthless. I might as well eat potato chips and drink tequila. Be fierce about not going there. Stand in your own two shoes. Come out of your mind and into your body. Feel your feet on the floor, your hands at your side, your breath in your belly. Use your ears and listen to sounds. Use your eyes and see something, anything at all, as if you've just landed on planet Earth. And breathe. If you're still powering through by gritting your teeth and holding in your stomach, take a breath. A long one. Repeat often. Disengage from the crazy aunt in the attic, aka the bully, the judge, the inner parent. Everyone's got one, and she or he is not your friend. She wants to keep you small by protecting you from being disloyal to what once brought you love. Until you understand that she's wrong and that she's not you, true change is not possible. Be kind to the ghost children. Ghost children are parts of yourself based on memories, earlier impressions, and associations. They are frozen in time and see all of the present through memories of past painful experiences. Shower them with curiosity and tenderness. Watch them melt. Stop believing your thoughts. You are not your beliefs, opinions, emotions, or thoughts. Know the difference between what happens and your thoughts and interpretations of what happens, between an actual experience and your reaction to it. Most of our thoughts, beliefs, and opinions are rigid, reactive, and wildly out of touch with our present situation. They can also lead to unnecessary anxiety, stress, and perceiving others as enemies that need to be vanquished. Drop the war. End the me project. Stop trying to get rid of, improve, resist, or otherwise fix yourself. With kindness, turn toward, not away from, what you believe you have to get rid of. In that turn, you will discover that demons become angels, and the scary snakes of your life become harmless strands of rope. Ask yourself, what's not wrong? Do this 5 times a day for 10 seconds at a time. You will be stunned at what happens when you see that it's almost always your mind, not the situation, that makes you miserable. Pay attention to what remains. When you're not possessed by your thoughts and stop taking yourself to be what happens to you, the background becomes foreground. What was up is down, and the noticer, rather than the noticed, is revealed. It's better than chocolate, better than sex, better than the perfect pair of boots. It's what you wanted from getting those things, multiplied by a quadrillion.
This messy, magnificent life, a field guide, was written and read by Janine Roth. It was recorded by John Rieger, with editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The music mix was by Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Elliot Rombach. This Messy, Magnificent Life was produced by Tara Thomas and directed by Jesse Boggs. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. This Messy, Magnificent Life, a field guide, is available in print from Scribner. Also by Janine Roth from Simon & Schuster Audio. Take Back Your Life, Ending Your Obsession with Food, and Women, Food, and God, An Unexpected Path to Almost Everything.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.